At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Something happened in Washington today that hasn't happened in a good long while.
Madam President, I'm pleased to announce that our bipartisan bicameral negotiations on defense spending and other priorities have yielded a significant agreement.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a budget deal. Fine print caveats do, however, apply. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, I believe, the 7th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who you heard right there at the top, and Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer shared the spotlight on the Senate floor today.
I'm pleased to announce that we have reached a two-year budget deal to lift the spending caps for defense and urgent domestic priorities far above current spending levels.
We will start with the good news, because that's what this is, at least one congressional chamber coming to an agreement about how to, in part, run the American economy. The deal in the Senate today, which does, yes, still have to be passed in the House and signed down at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, means we wouldn't have to worry about shutdowns or short-term funding bills until the middle of 2019, and thus would let the federal government get on about its business. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis was back at the White House today making the case to reporters yet again for a budget deal that would give the Defense Department some spending certainty. Mattis says without a budget this year, the Navy wouldn't be able to maintain its ships at sea.
We would have to ground aircraft due to a lack of maintenance and spare parts.
The Pentagon wouldn't be able to recruit more soldiers or airmen. Speaking on Skype, Catherine Blakely with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments says without shutdowns and continuing resolutions that just fund the government for weeks at a time, the Defense Department could make long-range plans.
Without having this whiplash effect where you have enough money to grow the Army in 1 year, but if you don't have that money next year, you have to cut the Army right back down to where it was.
The Senate budget deal would last two whole years, allowing federal workers to focus on their jobs instead of planning for a government shutdown. Linda Bilmes teaches public finance at Harvard.
I mean, I would really like the senior scientist at the Center for Disease Control to be working on disease prevention.
So no worries about shutdowns, but the Senate budget deal would bust right through the spending caps established to control the deficit. Spencer Perlman of Veda Partners says, remember, those caps were just temporary. They expire in 2021. And after that, it'll be a spending free-for-all.
In the 2000s, we didn't have any budget caps written into law, and spending went through the roof.
And our current national debt is over $20 trillion. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
With the caveat that tracking the intraday gyrations of the stock market isn't always super helpful, I did want to point out one thing here in light of the ups and downs we've seen since last Friday in the markets. You would have gotten a serious case of whiplash watching the Dow today. Blue chips ran up and down all day in a 500-point range, in other words, a lot, which gets me to this. One of the things we've heard the past couple of days from the White House and elsewhere is that the, and this is a quote, long-term economic fundamentals are good. Which is true, but it's also kind of not really helpful unless you know what they're talking about. So two stories on that topic. Now, first, from Marketplace's Mariel Segarra, the fundamentals as corporate America sees them.
When it comes to economic fundamentals for corporate America, things are looking pretty good.
Companies are doing very well right now. All of the signs are positive. Their sales are increasing. Consumer demand for their products are increasing.
That's Steve Odland at the Conference Board. He says corporate profits are also rising.
Halfway through the earnings season, about 80% of U.S. companies have beaten analyst expectations.
and profits will benefit from the new tax law. It cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. Dean Baker is an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Because they're paying a lower tax rate, companies are going to be keeping an even larger share of their profits.
There are some clouds on the horizon for companies. For one thing, it's getting more expensive for them to borrow money. Jody Lurie is an analyst at Janney Montgomery Scott.
That's going to affect their decision making when it comes to getting cash to either finance their balance sheet or to pay dividends or to pay share buybacks.
And for corporations, there was a downside to some economic news we got last week, that unemployment is low and wages are growing. Catherine Dominguez teaches economics at the University of Michigan.
We got some good news, I think, on the wage front, finally starting to see wages go up. But from the business point of view, that means they're going to be paying out more.
And higher costs are something companies worry about. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Okay, so on the theory that what is good or fundamental for companies doesn't necessarily line up with what is good or fundamental for the people in this economy, Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that flip side of the economic coin.
For most people, the strength of the economy comes down to whether their wages are rising or not. And wages are rising.
We're at a point where the unemployment rate is getting so low, it's starting to push up wages pretty strongly for the first time in years.
That's Chris Edwards at the right-leaning Cato Institute. But when you look at real long-term wage growth, that is wages minus how much inflation has gone up, salaries for most workers have been stagnant for decades, says David Madland at the left-leaning Center for American Progress.
The typical worker, their wages are still roughly where they were in the 1970s.
Household debt is growing, which Madland says shows people are more willing to spend but don't have the wages to support it. Consumer borrowing was up nearly 8% last quarter. Outstanding student loan debt is now at a record $1.5 trillion. And the personal savings rate has declined to a 12-year low. Greg Dacco at Oxford Economics says that's going to be an important metric to watch.
Because typically when consumers have very low savings, there's not that much buffer if some of the economic fundamentals start to turn around.
Long term, some economists worry about economic inequality, which Austin Goolsbee at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business says is clearly on the rise.
And there is a major argument going on among economists. Has the real standard of living for an ordinary American worker actually gone up at all in the last 25 years?
Nearly half of all Americans don't invest in the stock market, so they don't gain when stocks rise or lose when they fall. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, I alluded to bumpy, directionless, wandering. Those would all be good words. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today in possibly ginormous industrial conglomerate news, chips, the kind that go in smartphones, Broadcom said this week it's going to bump its offer for rival Qualcomm, the first made back in October, you might remember, to $121 billion. It'd be the biggest tech merger ever and would give the combined company a stake in basically every smartphone that is sold out there. Also, in a gesture of goodwill and intent, I suppose, Broadcom said it would be willing to pay a significant breakup fee if the deal is vetoed by regulators, significant here being perhaps $10 billion, and that's if the deal doesn't get done. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on these breakup fees and how they became so steep.
The traditional breakup or termination fee became popular in the 1990s. The idea was that if a target of a takeover backed out, it would have to pay the buyer a fee to compensate for time and resources spent negotiating the deal. The Broadcom-Qualcomm fee would be the exact opposite. Broadcom, the buyer, has said it would pay Qualcomm the target if the deal doesn't go through.
In order to understand these fees, you really have to look at, is it the target or the buyer that sort of bears the cost of initiating the transaction?
Espen Ekbo teaches finance at Dartmouth College. He says the poster child for this kind of reverse breakup fee came in 2011, when AT&T had to pay a record $6 billion when its plan to acquire T-Mobile couldn't get past regulators. Daniel Ives with GBH Insight says the amount of money paid in a breakup fee, like what's being talked about in the Qualcomm bid, says a lot.
What's unusual here is what could potentially be a $10 billion breakup fee. Significant breakup fees are usually signals to shareholders that companies think that this deal might not go through.
The target of a takeover could be left in a vulnerable position if that competitor doesn't end up buying them out. Mateo Arena, chair of the finance department at Marquette University, says when two tech companies like Broadcom and Qualcomm consider a merger, a lot of information is passed back and forth.
It's a form of compensation to ensure that this exchange of information is some way paid for.
Qualcomm is due to hold its annual shareholder meeting on March 6th. Even if there's a vote to go forward with the merger, passing regulatory scrutiny could prove a serious challenge. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There are, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, more than 2 million people in this country behind bars, mostly out of sight, but still in some ways part of the economy. Farming used to be a much bigger part of prison labor than it is today, but thousands of inmates still grow vegetables or feed crops for sale on the outside. And in the Montana prison system, they tend cattle. In the first of two stories on prison and big ag, Eve Abrams went to a prison ranch where inmates get job training and life skills and raise cows.
The Montana State Prison Dairy is a noisy place where inmates milk cows three times a day. 20 cows at a time walk into individual stalls where inmates dip the cow's teats in iodine and place suctioned milkers on them.
Average cow, it takes between 3 and 6 minutes to milk.
Dave Miller is the dairy manager. He says 32 inmates run the dairy and its processing plant, where the milk travels by vacuumed tubes to be homogenized, pasteurized, and made into yogurt, cottage cheese, and ice cream. But around 85% of the milk is sold to a national wholesale dairy company, slipping into our cereal bowls and coffee mugs alongside milk from regular dairies. The dairy is just one part of Montana Correctional Enterprises' cattle operation. Prisoners also raise beef cattle. Inmates herd some 2,000 cows grazing on 30,000 acres of alfalfa, ryegrass, and other cover crops. Clyde Johnson is on the cowboy crew, caring for and herding the cows. He's 49 now. He was 27 when he entered prison on multiple convictions from two serious violent crimes, a shooting and a rape. On any given workday, you can find Johnson on one of the prison's 40 horses.
We have Trigger, Copper, Billy Buck, Blackie.
Johnson also doctors cows, including aiding in birth. Sometimes.
You just look at them little calves and how can you not cheer up when you see them get up for their first time?
Johnson had to work hard to get this job. It took him 13 years of good conduct, not getting in any kind of trouble. He loves working with animals.
They're never in a bad mood, hardly. Like your horse, he's never mad at you. He's never grumpy.
Johnson makes around $1 an hour, the prison's top wage. He says working on the cowboy crew is hard on his body. He separated his shoulder, broken his sternum, but he's learned a lot. In Montana, Johnson's training is highly marketable. Ranchers call the prison just about every month looking for skilled inmates who are about to be released. Plus, landing a job on the outside significantly lowers the chance an inmate will end up back in prison. Every fall, a few hundred cattle leave Johnson's care en route to the dinner table. First step, cattle auction. Buyers from all over the country purchase thousands of cows, which come with papers, like a car, detailing their breed, weight, what they've been eating, and where they were raised. Buyers fatten up their cattle, mostly in feedlots, and then truck them to packing houses, where cows are slaughtered. And this is where details of a cow's birthplace, say a prison ranch, can easily slip from sight. Because food coming from a prison? It's not necessarily a selling point. A few years ago, when Colorado Whole Foods sold goat cheese made by inmates earning pennies an hour, consumers were outraged. Many shoppers didn't want to support what they consider exploitative labor. Rayburn Smith sells cattle for the Louisiana Department of Corrections. He says it's extremely common for some labels earned in prison ranches, like all natural or grass-fed, to follow the cows, because those labels get top dollar. But prison-raised?
I've never seen anything say that it was raised in a prison. You know, if there was an incentive to say they're raised in a prison, then we would probably sell them that way.
Many people recoil from prisons. They don't want a connection to them, especially one as personal as food. But for some inmates who produce that food, doing so is a lifeline to rehabilitation, a way to move forward with their lives. I'm Eve Abrams for Marketplace.
Eve's story was reported for us with support from the UC Berkeley 11th Hour Food and Farming Journalism Fellowship. Coming up.
I spoke to many engineers at Uber who said, yeah, in the middle of the day, we'd be invited to strip clubs and bondage clubs and to drink.
I'm pretty sure that's not okay. Silicon Valley's Brotopia, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's down 19 points today, pretty much unchanged, 24,893. Here's what I was talking about, though. The Dow off 127 at one point, up 381, and another point, make up your mind. People, the NASDAQ down 63 points, about 0.9%, 7,051. The S&P 500 dropped 13 points, about 0.5%, 26.81 there. Talked about that potential budget deal in Congress that would give the Pentagon some certainty when it comes to their spending priorities. So here's a look at some big defense contractors. Lockheed Martin flew up 2.3% today. Raytheon lifted about 1.5%. Bond prices, why they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.83%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. With the Trump White House having made clear that it's not going to lead the fight against climate change, state and local governments are looking for ways they can maybe get something done. And they are increasingly turning to the courts, filing suit against fossil fuel companies in particular. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
About 100 lawsuits related to climate change were filed during President Trump's first year in office, which seems like a lot. And it is, but
that is around the same number of lawsuits as we saw in the last year of the Obama administration.
Michael Berger is with the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia. He still sees the same kinds of suits that have gone on for years against federal agencies and states, but the litigation has also evolved.
One of the things that is new are a number of lawsuits that have been brought by cities and counties against the fossil fuel industry, alleging that those companies and their contributions to climate change are violations of state common law.
Eight California cities and New York City have all filed lawsuits against dozens of companies. They're seeking payment for damage from rising waters and more extreme weather, and for the protective infrastructure governments will have to build going forward. Vic Scher of law firm Scher Edling represents six of the California plaintiffs.
There are billions of dollars of property at risk, much of which has already started suffering impacts. So the cost of dealing with sea level rise have been and will be substantial.
Marin County in Northern California was one of the first to file. A decision in its favor would provide an example for other cities to follow. Is it even reasonable to hold oil and gas companies accountable for climate change costs? Yeah, says Kara Horowitz. She leads climate law research at UCLA's Emmett Institute.
These are exactly the kinds of suits, for example, that were brought about against tobacco companies and against lead paint companies here in California and elsewhere.
Now, lead paint companies are on the hook for a lot of neighborhood cleanup in California.
These are not frivolous suits. They're not crazy. Courts will take them seriously, and it's pretty clear that defendants are taking them seriously, too, based on how defendants have already begun responding.
Last month, ExxonMobil took initial steps toward a possible countersuit. Exxon did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Columbia's Michael Berger says the climate change plaintiffs could have a harder case than, say, the anti-tobacco lawsuits.
They're going to have difficult hurdles when it comes to proving a causal link between these particular defendants and the particular climate impacts that they're experiencing.
And they have a long road ahead. Lawyer Vic Scher doesn't expect a trial date for at least 3 years. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
If you're a regular listener to this program or just a news savvy person in general, it's not going to come as a big surprise to hear that there is sexism in Silicon Valley. And in fact, sexism somehow isn't a harsh enough term. The big tech companies, most of them anyway, have promised to do something about it and are making some modest progress. But the reality is, as Emily Chang, the host of Bloomberg Technology, points out in her new book, Brotopia, sexism and worse is literally part of Silicon Valley's origin story. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Great to be here.
I need you, to start at the beginning here. Tell me the story of Lena Soderbergh, would you?
It's a fascinating story, and it goes all the way back to 1973 and a group of engineers who were looking for a photo to test their algorithm. And it just so happened that there was a Playboy magazine lying around because no one thought it odd to bring that into the workplace.
Yeah.
And they happened to choose the one that was in the centerfold. And this photo has become the most popular photo used in image algorithm processing to this day, from the teams working on the Apple iPhone to Google Images. And, you know, for a lot of male engineers, the fact that it was originally a naked woman is sort of an amusing historical footnote. But for women, it has been very alienating.
There are details in this book, which I cannot say on a public radio program, that would make people blush or get angry. I encourage folks to read it because it's mind-boggling. But I guess my question is, were you surprised by the depth of the misogyny and the straight-out sexism? And there's racism as well and all kinds of different things. But to the point of this book, The Boys Club of Silicon Valley, did it surprise you?
It did surprise me how long bad behavior has been not just tolerated, but normalized. I mean, Susan Fowler, an engineer at Uber, mm-hmm. her first day on the job, she gets propositioned for sex by her manager.
We should say this is the woman who basically blew the lid off the culture at Uber, that horrible bro culture at Uber.
Absolutely. And perhaps the most shocking part about it is not that she was propositioned, but that she brought it to HR.
Right.
And they said, we're going to let this one slide because he's a high performer. And the reality is a lot of bad behavior has become the norm. And it's completely hostile for women.
Give me a sense, would you, of what it's like for your average, 32-year-old female computer engineer at your average Silicon Valley, not bajillion-dollar tech company, but some run-of-the-mill tech company trying to make a go of it.
So, number one, they're completely outnumbered. I mean, women make up 20% of prime technical roles, so engineers that you're talking about. And in some companies, bad behavior is just the norm. So I spoke to many engineers at Uber who said, yeah, in the middle of the day, we'd be invited to strip clubs and bondage clubs and to drink.
What?
At 3 in the afternoon, Uber had kegs open in the middle of the office. And if they left at 3 and didn't come back until 3 a.m., that was okay as long as they got their work done.
How much of a break does Silicon Valley get for the bad behavior becoming a norm because they invent all these cool things and they change people's lives, oftentimes for the better, but sometimes, not so much?
Right. They get quite a break because they can say, look what we've created. We
right.
made Facebook. We made Google. We made Apple. But that's exactly the reason that they shouldn't get a break. You've got mm-hmm. the smartest and richest people, some of the smartest and richest people in the world here. They've changed the world and they can change this too. Women make up a quarter of computing jobs. They're only getting 18% of computer science degrees. No other major has that kind of disparity. The top banks on Wall Street are close to 50-50 when it comes to gender parity. Silicon Valley needs to do better, and it can.
Well, yeah, it probably can, but do you think it wants to?
I think there certainly needs to be the will. And it just baffled me how this really progressive industry could have such grave inequality. If you talk to people, for example, I interviewed Twitter co-founder Ev Williams, and he told me that he thinks if there were more women on the team early on, that online harassment and trolling wouldn't be the problem it is today. They were thinking about cheerful and amazing things that could be done with Twitter. They weren't thinking, oh, how can my product be used to send death threats? We need women involved in making these products because they're shaping our future.
It's a book called Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley by Emily Chang. She is the host of Bloomberg Technology. You can see her on the TV, and you ought to read her book because it's kind of amazing. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out, a point that it's important not be lost in the hullabaloo over the Senate actually making a budget deal today. Just after that piece of sound I played earlier at the top of the newscast announcing the deal, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said this.
Alongside the increase in defense spending, the budget deal will lift funding for domestic programs by $131 billion. It will fully repeal the domestic sequester caps, while securing $57 billion in additional funding, including $6 billion.
He went on, I kid you not, for another minute and 15 seconds, listing all the new spending in this bill. Context demands that I note here that Congress just passed and the president signed tax cuts that add $1.5 trillion to the national debt. All right, we got to go. After an up and down day, the Dow Industrials closed down 19 points. We'll call that unchanged, flat-ish. NASDAQ down 63, 0.9%. The S&P 500 dropped 13 points, about 0.5% there. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.